Hello and welcome to The Brand Called You. This is a podcast and a video chat, and we're talking to some of the most interesting thought leaders from all over the world. My name is Lisa Lipkin, I'm your host. And if you're new to this channel and you like what you see, click the bell icon below and subscribe. I'm super excited today to introduce our guest, Dr. Jonathan Engel. He holds a full-time faculty post at the Marx School of Public Affairs at City University in New York. And his specialty is the historical evolution of US health and social welfare policy. He is a prolific author who's written a slew of books, including Poor People's Medicine about Medicaid and US charity care, The Epidemic, which is a history of AIDS, American Therapy, which is about the rise of psychotherapy in the United States, Unaffordable about American healthcare, and the book I want to focus on today, which absolutely fascinated me, Fat Nation, Obesity in America Since 1945. So Jonathan, welcome. And I suppose the place to start with is asking you, why obesity?
It's a good question. Lisa, thank you for having me here today. I became fascinated. I study healthcare, as you said. And we often focus on infectious disease and healthcare. And obviously, for the last 2 years with COVID, we've all been really obsessed with infectious disease. But in fact, in wealthy countries, the real issue these days is chronic diseases, non-infectious disease, but chronic disease. So the great problem, for example, is inflammation and autoimmune disorders. And we see long-term degradation of the cardiac system and of the neurological system, strokes and hearts, connective tissue, arthritis. So it's really this long, broad breakdown of the body that's really what's plaguing us in these wealthy countries. And as I began to look at this, what came up again and again was obesity. It's a co-risk factor for everything. It's a co-risk factor, obviously, for heart disease and for diabetes and for stroke, but also for joint issues, for depression, for inflammation. We've seen with startling clarity that it's a tremendous co-risk factor in COVID over the last 2 years, although this has come after I wrote the book. So everywhere I looked, I saw obesity. It shortens your life. It raises infant mortality. It raises maternal mortality. It makes every single interaction you have with the healthcare system more complex. If you have a minor surgery, a minor procedure, an endoscopic diagnosis, everything that you do in the healthcare system becomes more complicated and riskier if you're obese. And yet we can't seem to get it under control. It's everywhere. It's been rising at incredible rates for the last 40 years. It happened in the United States first, but virtually every other country in the world is catching up with us. We got fat first, but a lot of countries are not far behind us. And so I just became fascinated. Why can't we get this under control? It seems so easy, of course. We all know, just eat less and move more, and yet we can't seem to do it. And so I really began to try to understand what has happened over the last century, half century really, that has created this incredible problem.
Well, I mean, there's so many things in just what you said, but you mentioned COVID, so I just want to bring that up. Why do we not hear more about obesity and COVID? And I mean, you hear about diabetes, you hear about other risk factors, you know, they're always talking about people at risk, but I'm not hearing that much about its ties to obesity. Why is that?
So that's a great question. And it's been fascinating to me. I sound like a conspiracy theorist, it's because I am a little bit. I think it's really been very, very actively suppressed by the mainstream media. We know that COVID has tremendously disproportionate risk for the elderly. So if you knock out everyone over about age 80 or 85 who's died of COVID. And then we also know, obviously, it has substantial risk for people who are immunocompromised, people for whom their immune systems are not working very well. Knock out those two high risk groups. And what you're left with is a group of people who've been seriously ill or died who are extraordinarily disproportionately obese, which just seems to be squelched by the media. To be, if you are somewhere in the young and middle aged, and you're not immunocompromised and you're not obese, your chance of dying from COVID is very, very low. When you're obese, it shoots through the roof. We know this and we can't seem to get the message out. And I sometimes really wonder if it's being actively suppressed, partially maybe with the notion that people are responsible for their own death. We're very, very reluctant to go down that path. It may be that the public health establishment has wanted to make the sound riskier than it is. And so you worry if you point out how closely correlated with obesity it is, it gives people a pass on taking responsibility for avoiding COVID. I'm not really sure. And interesting that you brought up diabetes, Lisa, because in fact, diabetes per se is not the co-risk factor. It's obesity in and of itself. You can be obviously, obesity and diabetes are very closely correlated, particularly type 2 diabetes. So obesity and type 2 diabetes are very closely correlated, but they're not perfectly correlated. It's possible to have type 2 diabetes without being obese. And it's certainly possible to be obese without having type 2 diabetes. And yet when we really see the risk factor, it's not on diabetes, it's on the obesity itself. That is, if you're obese, even without diabetes, you're still at substantially higher risk of dying of COVID. Why? Why is it? Because diabetes obviously plays with all sorts of endocrinological systems. It's not surprising that if you're diabetic, you would be at higher risk for COVID. So why simply obesity? And here's kind of the answer, and I'm sure we'll get into this as we talk today. When our fat is an organ, we have a hard time seeing that. We tend to think of fat as this inert tissue, but the fat actually is an organ, and parts of fat, there are different kinds of fat in our body, but the kinds of fat that are around your abdomen, belly fat, brown fat, are actually metabolically active. They actually do release hormones and they stimulate the hormone system. One of the things that we know about about obesity, and it's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that obese people have a much, much harder time modulating their inflammatory response, right? And inflammation in our world of long-lived people in the Western world and in Japan and Australia, inflammation is everything. It's what's killing us all and our inability to pull inflammation down. When you're young, you have a much easier time modulating your inflammatory response. It's one of the reasons that we age and we die. It's one of the things, reasons why so many of our systems work less well, less effectively as we get older, because we can no longer modulate our inflammatory response. Obesity makes it all worse, much worse. Take one more step. What we know about COVID is that most people who die of COVID or get seriously ill are not really dying of the viral infection per se. They're dying of their own inflammatory over-response to the virus, right? It's what's killing you is the cure. The cure itself becomes worse than the disease. And obesity in every way is exacerbating that overwrought inflammatory response. So to be obese today in a world of a COVID pandemic is to be at very high risk. This should be trumpeted by public health authorities, and yet it's not. And I don't really know why. I'm not a media expert. I'm not a scholar of the media. But I will tell you, I read article after article after article in the mainstream press about COVID, and rates are rising, and hospitalization is rising, and no one touches on obesity. How many of these people being hospitalized are obese? How many who are dying are obese? It's really remarkable.
I mean, you did allude to it earlier when you said maybe it's because we still blame ourselves as if it's some moral failing. Is that possible?
Well, that's right. One of the problems we have in healthcare generally is this notion of culpability. How responsible are you? How much blame do you bear for your own ill health? And sometimes, obviously, not at all, right? We know that a great deal of cancer is genetic and you're genetically prone to cancer. It would be very hard to beat someone up for getting breast cancer. But then it gets very murky. For example, skin cancer, some people have a genetic predisposition towards skin cancer, and yet all of us place ourselves at a higher risk for skin cancer when we spend a lot of time in the sun without sun protection. So when someone gets skin cancer, are they totally blameless? Well, it's a little bit hard to say. If we know that we're undertaking risky behavior and we're not taking responsibility for the long-term consequences, then at a certain level, we are partially to blame for our own skin cancer, just like we're partially to blame for our own cavities if we don't brush our teeth, and our own gum disease if we don't floss, and our own heart disease if we don't eat healthy. All of these different ailments have a powerful genetic component to them, but they're also partially associated with our own behaviors. And that's true with obesity as well. There's a powerful, powerful biological component to it, which we'll talk about today. But obviously we have some ability to modulate our obesity. And one of the big questions, which we have a hard time grappling with, and in fact, I think we don't grapple with, is how much do we blame people for their own ill health, right? We live in a society where we're very reluctant to do that. And we certainly don't want to overblame people. None of us are fully responsible for our own situation in life, but perhaps there's some culpability. So it's a gray area, and it's an uncomfortable area for most of us.
So you mentioned that America was first. and obesity and the rest of the world is catching up. Why were we first?
That's a good question. There's a lot of different reasons. We tend to have very highly processed foods. So obesity is correlated with highly processed foods and a Western diet. We had sort of the most Westernized of all diets, which is the highest sugar, the highest amounts of white flour, the highest amounts of the removal of fiber and whole grains from our diet. So just the way we processed our foods created a food environment was part of it. Part of it was also our built environment. We're a very large country. We were the first country to adopt private automobiles on a mass basis. So that there was a great statistic back in, I think, 1940, there were more automobiles in the state of Michigan than there were in the entire United Kingdom, right? 10 times the size. So when we invented the automobile, when Henry Ford first started putting out the Model T, America looked at it and said, yes, we love this. This is just what we need. Everyone lives 5 miles away from the nearest farm, and we love this. And we placed an enormous priority on getting automobiles out, building road infrastructure out, building petroleum infrastructure out. Other countries went much slower. Europe was much more densely settled. There was a longer tradition of public transportation. There was a longer tradition of tight, dense, walkable cities. And so our whole lifestyle was always less pedestrian, less active, built more on excess and built more on highly processed foods. There's all sorts of other reasons too, but we just seem to get there first. But as I say, almost every country is catching up. There's a couple of exceptions. A handful of countries are managing to stay thin for a little while longer, although I think they're going to catch up too. But really, everyone's catching up. And I like to point out to people, I'm of a certain age. You and I are roughly the same generation. And I grew up with this notion of people in South Asia as being very, very hungry. This was kind of the classic trope. My mother said, finish what's on your plate. There are kids starving in India. This was sort of something a lot of our generation heard. Well, first of all, there are very few kids starving in India anymore, but more germane to this conversation is there are more and more obese people in India. In fact, India is on the cusp of a wild obesity epidemic. So yes, even rather poor countries are rapidly catching up. You don't need to be rich to become obese.
You wrote a great line in your book, we evolved to be lazy.
Yeah.
and that we stop walking basically. And what's, I'll never forget, being invited of as a child lived in Zurich for a year. My father did a sabbatical. He's a scientist.
Yeah.
And my best friend ended up growing up and having a son of her own and invited me to her child's 13th birthday party in Zurich. And I said, great. And she said, yeah, we're going to be at a camp. I rented out this outdoor campground about 2 miles away from, our apartment. We're gathering at my apartment and then we'll go to the campsite. So I kept looking for the minivan or the bus, but actually the minute all the kids gathered, they just started walking the 2 miles to the, and subsequently, I worked a lot in Europe, and every time I'd have a gig, they'd put me in a hotel and they'd say, and the venue is about 2 miles down the road. You'll find it, no car, no, the idea of being picked up to be taken less than, a couple of miles was unthinkable to this day in Europe.
Right. I have a couple of fun anecdotes about this. One is, I don't know if you know this, but the country of Japan, it's actually national law that school has to be walkable. So it's not possible in every single rural town, but it's an enormous priority. And Japanese kids walk to school without parental accompaniment from a very young age. They tend to walk in clusters. This is just considered an ordinary, very, very important part of life. Two other things I want to point out just about the way culture shapes our activity. We are very, very much cultural animals and social animals, and we take our cues from people around them. Years and years ago, I was sitting watching the old Hound of the Baskervilles with Basil Rathbone, made in the 1930s, I think. It's one of these wonderful movies with Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Watson. And Dr. Watson starts one day, he says, I decided that morning to take a walk across the moor into town. It was an easy walk, 4 miles each way. And of course, for most Americans, this is unthinkable. For us, an 8 mile walk is like, if you can do it at all, it's a major dedicated exercise, right? For them, it was simply part of normal transportation. It was an errand. 8 miles on the way to do an errand was absolutely ordinary life. I want to talk about two other things that really hit me as I was writing this book. One of the countries that's actually doing a little better in the world is France. There's a handful of countries that are doing, they're all getting heavier, but they're getting heavier more slowly. They're keeping their weight down. Norway is one of them. France is one of them. Japan is one of them. So the French tend to eat diets that look like American diets. French food looks similar to American food. It's not
like Ethiopian food,
which looks radically different, right? Yeah. So what are the French doing differently? Well, a huge part of what the French are doing differently is they're not snacking nearly as much, and they're also eating much, much smaller portions. So I want to tell you a story. About 4 years ago, my wife and I took a long weekend in Paris. Who doesn't love that? It was a summer. And on a Thursday evening, we went over to the Jardin du Luxembourg, which is sort of the central park of Paris. And it was a Thursday evening, about 7:30 in the evening. It was glorious. Hundreds of people out, couples with little babies at the playground, young singles sitting around, older guys playing bocce ball. Just, it was a wonderful, wonderful evening in Paris. It was 7:30 at night. There was not a single person putting a piece of food into their mouth. And there were no signs that said it was not allowed. There wasn't a mother putting Cheerios into her kid's mouth on the swing set. There wasn't anyone eating popcorn or licking an ice cream cone. No one. There were people smoking. And I think there was one group of sort of young adults maybe sharing a bottle of wine, but not a single person was putting food into their mouth at Thursday, 7:30. If this were the United States in a public park, everyone would have been putting food in their mouth. People would have had big gulp drinks, they would have had popcorn, they would have had ice cream cones, they would have had sandwiches. There would have been food at almost every juncture. In the United States today, we've integrated eating into almost every single thing we do. It's almost impossible not to be eating. In France, they still really cleave to the idea that you eat at mealtimes and no other time. It's simply inappropriate and unacceptable to be eating when it's not mealtime.
I mean, I think you're hitting on something more profound, which is this inability to curtail impulse control. Like, in other words, just because you have hunger, you don't have to satiate it, right? And I wonder if there's something about American culture, which is so fear-based that, you know, the minute you have hunger, if you don't eat, then I wonder if we're indoctrinated to feel that, you know, feelings of hunger are actually dangerous. As opposed to
I don't know, Lisa. That's an interesting question. Why have we become almost obsessed with constantly sating ourselves? I don't know what it is. I mean, if you're very cynical and you're an anti-capitalist, you'll say it's about people making money. I mean, you know, the more donuts people eat, the more the donut companies can sell you donuts. I don't know if it's that. I'm really not sure. It maybe is part of our agrarian past where just 100 years ago, most of us were farmers and we burnt enormous amounts of calories. And so it really did make sense to be throwing carbohydrates down our throats all day long. I don't really know. I will tell you that Europeans and Japanese are mystified when they come here. So you'll see this, a bunch of European businessmen and businesswomen come over for a business meeting, 10 o'clock in the morning, they're in the corporate boardroom, and all of a sudden a platter appears, a platter of bagels, a platter of donuts, 10 o'clock in the morning. And the Europeans go, they look at their watches. They're like, it's not lunchtime. I don't understand. Did people not have time to eat breakfast? Yeah. That would have been at 7. This is 10 and lunch won't be till 12. So what's this food doing here? And for the Americans, this is utterly natural. How could you have a business meeting without a platter of bagels? It's just, and by the way, people eat it. Once the bagels are out, people kind of, well, I wasn't really hungry, but I'll put it in front of me. I'll nosh a little, I'll nibble a little. So we are weak, we're prone to suggestion. One of the things the Europeans know is if you don't put the bagels out, people won't bring a bagel. They're not gonna bring a bagel to the meeting. But once you put the platter out, now the cat is out of the bag. Now it requires enormous restraint to not eat the bagel.
Yeah.
So one thing that thin people know is not to just resist temptation, but to remove the temptation entirely. It's not just thin people, it's all of us who managed to kind of achieve our goals, we learn to remove temptations from our lives because we're weak, right? And yet we have made it almost impossible to remove food from our lives. I like to point out, I have a slight weakness for Snickers bars. Who doesn't, right? And I walk from Penn Station to my office most mornings. It's about 25 blocks. I think I have to pass 40 Snickers bars on the way. Every single kiosk on every corner is selling a Snickers bar. Every drugstore selling a Snickers bar, every convenience store. I have to say no to 45 Snickers bars just to get from the train station to my office. And then I have to say no again on the way back. In the morning, it's not so hard for me. By 5 o'clock in the afternoon, that is killing me. It's taking every ounce of willpower I have to say no to 45 Snickers bars on every block, right? Far easier if we just got the Snickers bar out of the environment entirely.
But I mean, you bring up a good point, which is that really we're up against the primitive brain that is demanding sugar, right? It's demanding right. calories. I mean, just talk a little about, I mean, why it's so hard to resist temptation. In other words, are we losing the battle against our more primitive brain?
We are. So first of all, I would say that obesity is really genes meets environment. When one of the things I found, I thought there were a number, this isn't all me, there were a lot of people who thought about this. And a lot of us beat ourselves up if we're overweight and we say, what's wrong with me? There's a deficit in my character, right? If I was really a strong, rigorous, disciplined person, I would resist this. We all know to get thin, we need to eat less. So why can't I? Why am I so weak? And by the way, why were we not fat 60 years ago? What has changed? So I read a very good psychologist who said, look, clearly there's no shortfall in human discipline. Our characters have not degraded in 60 years. There's no evidence to suggest that people have less character today. And in fact, human beings, if anything, we're working harder and longer hours. So we are able to be very, very disciplined. We're staying in school for more years. We're working longer. We're working longer hours. We work more intensely. So an awful lot of measures would suggest, no, we are just as disciplined as we ever were, if not more disciplined. Our characters and our self-restraint have not eroded. That's not what's changed. So what has changed is the environment, is that 60 years ago, we did not live in an obesogenic environment, and today we do. Today, it's almost impossible to resist the amount of food around us. It's everywhere, and it requires enormous amounts of willpower to resist. I can't walk into my local Home Depot without passing a Dunkin' Donuts. Why is there a Dunkin' Donuts in a hardware store? Literally, it's right there. I need to go in to buy a screwdriver or to buy some screws, and I've got to walk by a Dunkin' Donuts. And so all of a sudden, it's another point where I have to say no, I have to exercise self-restraint. Why is the Dunkin' Donuts even there? Who thought that was a good idea? Well, Dunkin' Donuts thinks it's a good idea, they can sell you donuts. But from a societal standpoint, this is a disaster, because every one of us now has to say no each time we walk into the hardware store. That's what's changed. Those donuts are everywhere. Going back to that example of the bagel platter in the meeting, if the bagels weren't in the meeting, none of us would be eating bagels, right? None of us run out in the middle of the meeting and say, I'm starving, let's take a 5-minute break so I can buy a bagel. Nobody does that. And in fact, most of us don't bring a bagel into the meeting. But once someone puts the platter there in the middle, now you've given all of us permission. And now all of a sudden it requires enormous, but it requires substantial willpower to resist the bagels once they're there. Why are some people staying thin in the midst of all this? And obviously about 30% of people still are staying a healthy way. Some people are working at it enormously hard. There are people who really, they really would naturally be fat, and they are investing enormous amounts of willpower in doing physical activity and planning their meals. It really becomes a tremendous priority in their life. It's hard to do, but a few people can do it. There are some people who actually just are born with far, far lower food cravings. If you're really one of these people who doesn't get hungry, the bagels are not a temptation. And I'd like to point out, I have a friend who's just one of these tall, skinny drinks of water. He's 6'1". He probably weighs about 140 pounds. And I one time asked him, do you need to work at it? He said, never. He said, in fact, I actually have to work at keeping weight on. It's like my whole life I've been skinny. So he stopped by my house. He was driving down and passing my house in New Jersey. He called me from the phone. He said, I need to stop to take a bit of a break. Could I just sit on your porch maybe and we'd have a bit of lunch? I said, I'd love to. What a treat, right? I said, do you want me to make you lunch? He said, no, I brought a sandwich. I'm fine. So we sit down on my porch and I get him a glass of water and he pulls out a sandwich and we start talking. And I literally have to remind him to eat a sandwich. It's sitting there in his hand and he keeps forgetting to eat the sandwich. It's like, it's not speaking to him at all. That's why he's so thin. The food poses no temptation for him at all.
That's a hormonal switch that
is hormonal. It's hormonal. He was born with that. By contrast, most of us, if you're someone who is naturally overweight, which is most of us, that sandwich is calling to you. It's sitting there in your hand. And in fact, you almost can't concentrate on the rest of conversation. If you talk to people who really struggle with their weight, when they're around appetizing food, it's almost like it hijacks their brain. Like light bulbs are going off in their brain. It's almost like heroin. It's hitting the same dopamine receptors. They can't concentrate on the conversation because of all these delicious things in front of them. For my skinny friend, those things don't talk to him. There are no light bulbs going off. So it's not that he's more disciplined than I am. It's that the temptation doesn't exist for him. And that's just the way he was born. But that's rare. That's not most of us. That's a few of us.
But, you know, and again, you can speak to the social policy surrounding this, but you would never have a heroin stand in a Home Depot.
Right.
You would never even
or a liquor store,
right. Bar. I was going to say, why is it that we don't see a Dunkin' Donuts or sugary treats as the next heroin? I mean, why are we not? I mean, we're starting to, but I mean, why have we lagged so far behind in terms of understanding this?
And in fact, that was really the essential question of my book. Once I really began to understand what's going on, that we've created an environment that is obesogenic, where it's almost impossible for most of us to stay healthy weight, right? So then the answer in my mind, but then I believe in government, is regulation. If we have substances in our environment which are potentially dangerous and are somewhat addictive, kind of mildly addictive, then the thing we usually do with things like that is we either outlaw them entirely like heroin or we regulate them like alcohol. Yes, you could buy alcohol, but you can't walk down the street drinking alcohol, and you can't buy a gallon of whiskey. You can only buy a quart of whiskey, and you can't buy it before you're age 18 or before age 21 and whatever. We put all sorts of fences around alcohol because we understand that it is dangerous and bad for your health and potentially addictive, right? And I think we're even doing the same thing with marijuana, even as we now legalize marijuana. You can't just walk into a CVS and buy marijuana. You have to go to a specialized dispensary. It has to be licensed. There are all sorts of rules about where you can and cannot consume marijuana, right? You're theoretically, you're not supposed to just be walking down the street. So why have we not applied similar standards to sugar and to sort of, and to other kinds of foods, junk foods? And there's a couple of answers, and I don't really know the exact answer. One is we all have to eat. So food per se, it's a little bit harder. With marijuana and there's not marijuana. But with food, there are certain kinds of food which clearly we would like to discourage: high sugar, high glycemic, low protein, low fiber. And there are other kinds of foods we would like to encourage people to eat more of, like vegetables, right? Fresh produce, fresh vegetables, lean protein. And so we really have to begin to make distinctions about what's good food and what's bad food. Well, that's very, very uncomfortable. That begins to encroach on becoming a nanny state or a police state, right? Do you really want the government making a list of which foods you should be eating and which foods you don't?
I think about, you know, subsidizing the corn industry and the corn syrup that emerges as a result. I mean, isn't it highly political anyway? Aren't we making those decisions?
It is. It is. But, you know, it's a reasonable question, though. You know, I mean, I will tell you, here's an easy one. So we all know that Twizzlers are junk food. That one's easy. But are you aware, for example, that granola bars are also junk food? And I mean, they really are junk food. A granola bar has more sugar in it than a Hershey's bar. A granola bar is junk food.
I didn't know
that. And so it would be easy enough to say we really don't want 9-year-olds buying Twizzlers. But how do you say we really don't want 9-year-olds buying granola bars? A lot of people think of granola bars as sort of healthy. It has oats in it. It has nuts in it. It's like, no, that's really, you're just eating candy. A glass of orange juice is candy, nutritionally speaking, right? Yeah. So we would really have to educate people a lot on what they're eating. I don't think we're ready to do that. I think most people don't want government playing that sort of role in their lives. I just don't think we're there yet. That said, Lisa, if I could, we're not asking the government to do it, but if you look at wealthy, educated parents, they're already doing it, right? So one of the things that wealthy people do, wealthy people tend to be much thinner in this country. One of the things that wealthy people do is they circumscribe their food environment. So if you walk into a typical public school, there's a candy machine with all sorts of crap, chips and candy bars and sodas being sold. If you walked into a prestigious Manhattan private school, it would not be there. The parents have gotten it out of there. So they didn't ask the state to come and regulate the food environment. The parents regulated it for the children. They just get it out of there. They don't want the kids eating that stuff, and they regulate that microenvironment. And that's one of the things that wealthy people do, is they control the environment around them and they make the environment more salubrious, right? Well, if it's the right thing for the fancy private school kids, shouldn't it also be the right thing for the public school kids too? This would not be so hard to get the candy machines out of the public schools, but we're having a hard time doing it.
Yeah. I had a couple things I wanted to ask you before we conclude. I mean, I spent, when I was 33, I lived for a year in Israel, and I developed a sort of parasitic condition. I don't know how, but it was treated when I got back to America. But right after that, I put on about 30 or 40 pounds. And it started in kind of an obesity problem with me that kind of never resolved itself. And I wonder, you know, you talk about gut biome and external forces that parasitic or toxicity that can really affect obesity. Are these things, are some of these external kind of forces?
Yeah, well, we're learning more about obesity all the time and how complex it is. Your appetite is really very, very tightly controlled through your hormonal system, through the vagus nerve, through a series, it's actually a series of rather complex hormonal interactions that go back and forth. There's a satiation hormone, there is a hunger hormone, there are actually multiple hunger and multiple satiation hormones. It's more complex than you think. So I think we could start by saying eating per se is less volitional than you want to believe. Some people like to say, I eat what I want to eat. It's like, no, you don't. You actually eat what your hormones are telling you to eat. And exercise is less volitional. It's more social than you want to believe. Both eating and exercise are both social and they're biological. They're less independent choices than you want to believe. You experienced, it was a perfect controlled experiment that you didn't have a problem with your weight before you got this parasite. Yes. And after you had the parasite, you couldn't control it. And there are many people who have discovered when they're under certain kinds of medications, certain kinds of antidepressants, they start putting on weight and they'll say, I never had a trouble with weight before. I ate what I wanted to eat. I stopped eating when I wasn't hungry. I kept my weight down. And all of a sudden I can't stop eating. I'm taking this new medication and I'm hungry all the time. I put on 20 pounds. Other people find that when they stop smoking, nicotine is an appetite cessation product, right? And this is the classic thing of tons of people who've stopped smoking over the last half century have learned that they can quickly put on 10, 15, 20 pounds because they've removed a drug from their diet, which was actually an appetite suppressant, right? So yes, so many things about the way we eat are really more biological than we want to admit. And we do need to think biologically. Are there triggers? Are there biological triggers that are going on? Sugar clearly is really problematic. And if we had time, I could really go into why sugar is problematic. But we do need to accept that much of our appetite and much of our weight are driven biologically. And we need to stop beating ourselves up about it. I think that the answer is to change our environment, not to try to change us. I think it's
okay.
A fool's
error. Isn't fat shaming biologic too? And the reason I ask you that is, no, when I put on the weight, I noticed it's not just that I was invisible. I noticed that particularly men would be a little bit mean. And I remember thinking when, you know, there was such a profound difference in the level of niceness towards me. And I thought, this can't just be cultural. There has to be, like, as if there must be some biologic imperative for them to drive away the overweight person because they're not like of procreative value or something. I just wondered, is fat shaming just cultural? Or is it possible that the kind of, you know, the despair that fat people feel socially is really fueled by something that's beyond just culture?
So Lisa, first of all, I'd say it's not just men, it's women shame fat.
That is
women.
True. That is true.
It's both ways.
Are we biologically designed to fat shame?
So fat shame is a little harsh. I would say we are very, very visual and we are exquisitely sensitive to visual markers of health and youth and fertility.
Okay.
So maybe that kind of diffuses a little bit. We are exquisitely aware of it. We're incredibly good at discerning someone's age, right? If you think about it,
right.
Not a whole lot. You couldn't discern a dog's age particularly well, or a chimpanzee's age particularly right. well, or an elephant's age. If you looked at an elephant in the zoo, and if I said, is that elephant 4 years old or 40 years old, you would have no idea.
Right.
But if I asked you to just look at someone you've never met, if they haven't had all sorts of plastic surgery and dyed their hair, and if I said, you know, but if they just looked normal or looked whatever. and if I said to you, is that woman 20 years old, 40 years old, or 60 years old, you could probably get it within about 3 years. We're actually very, very good at this. And there's powerful evolutionary reasons why we're good at this, right? We've evolved to be able to discern fertility and to be able to identify youth and to be able to identify health. Men and women both do it. It's why we recoil from skin ailments, because it's such a clear visual indicator of perhaps underlying poor health. It's why we're so focused on hair. Hair itself is actually a very good indicator of health, how lush your hair is, how glossy it is, the color of your hair. There's all sorts of indications, and we're very, very good at reading it. And one of the things we read is body type. Almost everyone's body begins to expand in the middle as they age, and this has always been true. So we look for those waistlines, right? So when someone says, what's wrong with you? Why are you judging that person on his or her weight, particularly her? The answer is, what do you mean, what's wrong with you? This is what I was evolved to do. Now, I can learn to not judge someone, but I'd have to be blind not to see it. That's just utterly unrealistic, right? So, and as I say, both men and women look and judge by people's bodies.
So you're pointing out two things, both that we're ridiculously products of our own evolution and biology, and yet we also have some control over changing it. Do you see, as we move forward, how that there's any hope of stemming the tide of obesity? That can we make any real profound changes, or are we just going to basically get worse and worse? Or so, is there hope?
I think we could, but we're not there yet. We're actually still not taking this really seriously. I think if we really wanted to get serious about our weight, we would actually have to profoundly change the way we live. We'd actually have to work fewer hours. We'd have to commute shorter distances. We would all have to commit to building in more exercise into our life. And I'll just give you one of these good historical statistics. If we look at pre-automobile human beings, so 19th century, roughly, really essentially before there was maybe a few people had access to a railroad from 1830, but pretty much anytime you wanted a locomote, it was either by foot or by horse. A typical American in the mid-19th century, a male was walking between 13 and 16 miles a day, and a woman was walking between 9 and 10 miles a day. If you lived on a farm, this is what you did. It was built in. You got up in the morning, and by the time you went to bed at night, you had walked 10 miles every day. So when people say, wow, there were no gyms, of course there were no gyms. You were burning off 1,200 calories just in walking every day, never mind lifting up pails of water from the well and shoveling hay out from the hay barn, right? So it was just integral to our lives to do that amount of physical activity. We need to reinstitute and to reintegrate that kind of activity into our lives. And that takes time. You can't walk 10 miles in 20 minutes, right? It takes hours. And we would really have to think about the way we're spending our time. We'd have to spend less time watching screens, less time commuting, less time sitting on our butts at the office, and more time actually physically engaged activity. I said there were several countries in the world that are keeping their weight down. One of them is Norway. So the Norwegians are keeping their weight down. And Norwegians actually eat crappy food. Norwegians eat basically Northern European Germanic food. It's heavy, it's starchy, it's fatty. It's not great food, right? So why are the Norwegians staying thin? The Norwegians are staying thin because they move like crazy. It is, as a nation, they work fewer hours. Remember, they've got these huge oil wells as a national trust fund. So people, and it's a social welfare state. So there's less of an incentive to work long hours. And there's a national culture of movement. Everyone is outside moving, exercising every day. And it starts as youth. And it really makes a difference. If it's just built in, if it's part of social discourse, part of social interaction, where just movement is part of it, it just becomes very, very natural. You don't need to fight it. The same thing can be also said, by the way, of the Amish in this country. By far, the thinnest subgroup of people in this country are Amish children. Now, they get fat when they get older, but Amish children are rarely, rarely fat. Why? There's no cars. If an Amish child wants to play with her friend, she's got to walk 4 miles down the road. This is just built into her life. And by the way, Amish food is also crap, right? It's not crap, but Amish food is not particularly healthy. It's old, heavy, Germanic, rural food, right? A lot of fat, a lot of carbohydrates. But Amish children just move an enormous amount. So that really requires a commitment to thinking about our lives. That's not just about thinking about what we're eating. It's about thinking about, what does our day look like? Where are those 3 hours of movement going to come into this day? You'd have to change the way you structured your day. Right?
And I guess it's possible to think about that on a large scale as well, to integrate.
You could. As I say, I think we can. We're not there yet. I just haven't heard it. I haven't heard this as a political issue. I've heard very little leadership on this. If anything, there's a little bit of pushback. There's more of a, you just, as you say, sort of fat acceptance. Instead of sort of saying, how do we all learn how to be thinner? What I hear more of is, what do we need to do to accept us all as fatter? I'm not sure that's really our goal here. Our goal is to get thinner. We don't have to be rail thin, but there are all sorts of reasons why life is better and richer and fuller if we can be thinner.
Well, thank you. This is, I could go on and on, but this was really, really, and I'm immediately going to go for a walk as soon as I hang up. But thank you so much for this. And what are you working on now, your next project?
Thank you. I'm writing a book on the social, on some of the anti-poverty programs in the 1960s and changing dimensions of poverty discourse, the way we think about poverty.
Which is, of course, tied to obesity as well.
Which is, of course, tied to obesity, very much so. Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Jonathan. I wish you all the best in all your upcoming projects. And
thank you, Lisa. Thank you.
Yes, I really appreciate it. Okay, yeah. Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website, www.tbcy.in, to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.